I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another season.
Another.
Not just edition.
This is not just any other season. This is actually our 10th anniversary.
10 years of Words on a Wire.
That
is so hard to believe. And it makes me feel so old because I remember when I was young, 10 years seemed like such a long time ago. But it just seems like we started. We just barely started.
Yeah, that's older than me.
How many years have you been doing it?
Let's see, for 4 years. I've been doing it for the last 3.5, actually, because I first semester. I did. But yeah, 3.5 years.
Wow. This is our 10th year on Words on a Wire.
Celebrate.
We've had so many great producers. Remember Norma Martinez?
Oh,
he was one of our greatest producers.
How could I forget?
And then we went through, a few producers, and they were in and out.
I know.
But then we got Lauren.
Then we got the fabulous,
the Razas.
Magical.
And man.
Lauren.
Oh, jeez. And she's amazing. And her editing skills and her producing skills.
I know.
But now she's leaving.
No.
And the ironic thing is, you know where she's going?
Where is she going, Daniel?
To work with Norma Martinez, our first producer.
In San Antonio.
In San Antonio. They're going to be working
together. San Antonio
together.
Steals all the good ones.
I know. So we don't know who our producer is, but we're glad that she's still here and she's on the other side of the glass right now. Lauren Martinez, we're really going to miss you. But
Lauren Terrazas.
I'm sorry. See, I got
Norma Martinez.
Norma Martinez.
Oh, I see.
I got to put together.
Okay.
And anyway, give our love to Norma when you get there, and thank you for everything. She's been a fantastic producer. Right. Yeah, 10 years. I'm learning a lot how to do radio, and I think in another 10 years I might be kind of good at it.
You might be kind of good? Yeah.
But you're a natural.
No, not at all. Are you kidding? No. But here's the thing is that, when I first came in here 3.5 years ago and started doing this show, I had everything scripted to the T, like every word I was going to say and everything.
I remember that.
I did that the whole first 6 months. Yeah, so now, obviously I don't have my laptop with me, so I'm...
That's funny, because when I saw
I
you
free,
walking
man.
Into the studio, not only do you not have your laptop, you didn't have a notebook, you didn't have anything.
Yeah.
I thought,
but
wow,
I am prepared, Daniel.
He's going to have fun today. Well, that's what it's all about, right?
I think
what I tend to do, or at least what I tended to do initially, and I think I still do it, is I over-prepare.
Yeah.
I do
it's
too
good,
many,
though.
I have more questions than I ever have the possibility to get to, which works well because sometimes, if you're stuck, you just go into your bag of questions, pull one out, and the labyrinth of conversation goes, who knows where.
But, in this 10th one, we have a really... We're going to kick it off with a special guest.
Season 10, episode 1.
Episode 1 with our
very,
special
very
guest.
Special guest.
Very special guest.
Who is it again? He's in the studio right now. His name's Dr. Nelson Cárdenas, and he is a poet from Cuba. I'll give a little bit of his background in just a second, but... he's a poet from Cuba who has just joined us as a tenure tacky. He's kind of tacky. Tenure tacky professor in the Department of Creative Writing as our new poet and our film studies component.
That's
Nelson,
right.
Welcome.
Welcome, Nelson.
Thank you, guys.
To Words on a Wire and to UTEP and Tenure Track.
Thank you so much.
Should I read a little bio, or do you want to?
I think you should. Yeah, I think we should let the listeners know who we're talking with.
Well,
we're dealing with here.
well, essentially, he is. Like I said, he's from Cuba. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called "Isla que no existe," which came out in Cuba in 2002. He got his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in Hispanic Studies. Mm. And among his research interests are masculinities, film, and I think the lost generation of literature. He is from Havana, Cuba. And anytime anybody meets him, they're completely, completely charmed. Because he's so gregarious, he's very outgoing, and a lot of the students say he looks like Javier Bardem.
That's right, he does.
And I go, no, he doesn't. He's better looking. Damn it!
Yeah, he's better looking and smarter.
So, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I'm sorry I'm going to disappoint your listeners with, after that introduction. There's not much to offer, right?
Oh, yeah, are you kidding? Are you kidding? See, I told you.
We set the bar high for you, Nelson.
So Nelson, tell us how you came to El Paso and what so far do you think about living on the border between the U.S. and Mexico and such a really kind of significant border historically and for all of the Americas?
Well, I came protesting, I wasn't happy about coming here when my wife was offered, Dr. and poet Andrea Cote, was offered a position here at UTEP. And I just Googled El Paso, and I got really depressed.
What did you see? Like was, lack of trees?
A patch of land in the middle of nowhere. It was 9 hours and a half, I think, from the nearest ocean.
Wow.
That was traumatizing for me.
Somebody from Cuba, right?
Yeah. I haven't been more than, I don't know, like 3 minutes away from the water in my life.
Wow.
In my life.
Landlocked.
Either Cuba, Miami, Philadelphia, even New York. You know, I was by the river. So,
yeah.
But now I love it. I mean, this is home. We have a boy. He was born here. And I think El Paso is a great place to be. I think El Paso is a promising city. But beyond the promise, I think it's a city that is suffering already a lot in terms of culture, in terms of growing up, and especially in terms of the human quality of the city. I mean, yeah. I've been really, really impressed from the generosity and the kindness and you know, the will of the people of the city.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And, you know, we're in such a peculiar position right now because we are the only city in the country, I think, that have this kind of big binational experience. I know there are other places like Tijuana and so on,
right.
But I don't think they reach the magnitude of El Paso and Juarez together.
And even
right.
the way that is reflected in our department, our Department of Creative Writing, which is bilingual and which, you know, has students that come in from all over Latin America and students that come from North America.
Yeah.
And we share space. We share languages. Mm-hmm. We share misunderstanding of languages.
A lot.
Yeah, it's a unique place and kind of perfect for you.
Perfect for me. I prefer Spanish, but, you know, I have my English is not very good looking, as Celia Cruz said once. But I can manage.
Oh, that's wonderful. My English isn't very good looking.
Yeah. My Spanish
that's
is hideous.
Celia. That's Celia.
Spanish
that's Celia's
is incredibly ugly.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using
atrocious.
That.
Yeah, but, you know, El Paso also offers a lot in terms of bi-nationality. You know, I was impressed when I first came in here how the people from El Paso are closest to the people from Juarez than anybody. I mean, than anything. Else. I mean, they are closer, Texans that are closer to Mexicans in Juarez, and Mexicans that are closer to people in El Paso than to, you know, like Mexico City.
Yeah.
So right. It's just completely different. It's self-contained environment, if you want
right.
to.
That's
and
right.
it happens a lot of people just leave the city for work, studies, or whatever. And a lot of people return to the city. This is a good place to live. It's a good place
right.
to be. You know, here, be linguistically impaired means speaking just one language. I mean, most of the people here are bilingual.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah,
you know,
everywhere.
We have a lot of students from Latin America, and some of them don't speak English. And they, before they come, they think, well, I'm going to be in the U.S. for 3 years. Man, am I going to speak great English? But then they find that everywhere they go, no matter what,
they can
no matter
Spanish.
Where it is, everyone speaks Spanish. So
right.
Grocery
so
store, gas stations, anywhere.
Cops.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, everywhere. That's right.
Not that our students run into the cops very often.
Well, you know, also for somebody who is whose Spanish is hideous, you know, is very ugly.
Ugly, yes.
For someone like myself, whose Spanish is very ugly, you know, it's also nice to be able to utilize Spanglish in any situation.
Right.
You know, you can code switch and cross over anytime linguistically in any situation, in any place, and they're just with you on it.
Yeah.
They're with you on it. You can't do that anywhere else in this country. I mean, I've tried.
Right. And it's a great way for me personally to hide the fact that my Spanish sucks because I could say half a sentence in Spanish and then the other half in English because I don't know how to say it.
And they're with
it,
you. But, they don't even flinch. They don't even bat an eye. They just go, okay, got you. Here we go.
Also, you know, one of the things I found difficult is I'm always trying to improve my Spanish and being in, like when I travel abroad, like to, you know, Argentina or Mexico City or something, I have to use it every single day. But when I'm here, I never have to use it. As bilingual as it is, if I go into a place and I start speaking Spanish, once they hear my Pocho accent, they talk to me in English.
Yeah.
So, but it really is a very unique place. And you're a unique poet. Tell us how you got into, number one, how being a young Cuban man, you got into poetry.
How did poetry find you?
Yeah.
Well, I will save some details, but it was pretty late. I was, I think, 14, 13 years old. I am from a town in Havana that is by the ocean. And it's a very noisy and everybody knows your life, you know, a neighbor. I remember the neighbor just opening the door and walking all the way down to the kitchen. I would be in, like, my underwear. So I'm, you know, she would be talking with my grandma. So I found solace in books, and I didn't have much space to read. So I started, like, reading either really late at night or in the bathroom. I would lock myself in the bathroom. I would be there for an hour or so reading books.
Yeah.
And then something happened in the you know, in that summer from, I think I was 14 to 15 or 13 to 14, I just got hooked up. And I think it was from 14 years old to 15 mm-hmm. years old. And when I started in high school, back there is, you know, 15 years old, I just read like a maniac. I remember I was mm-hmm. reading everything. And I started by the classics. I don't know why I did that. Wow. But I started like reading Shakespeare in translation, of course.
Right. Wow.
And then I went like to El Siglo de Oro in Spanish literature.
Wow.
And then after that, you know, I opened up to new possibilities. And I remember I was in a boarding school in Cuba back in my time. Most of the schools were boarding schools.
Uh-huh.
And I will just step out of the bus that will deliver me to where my father was supposed to collect me. And I will stop by a bookstore and buy some books. And back in the time, it was mostly Cubans conversationalist poets, right? Like
right.
Rogelio Noguera, Raúl Rivero. And that was like my first touch, my first contact with contemporary poetry.
Mm.
It was that. But I started with the classic. I started with like reading like very old poetry first.
Wow.
And plays and novels. You know, I started with realism. I started with Balzac and, and Stendhal and so on. And then I moved.
What about those books that you were reading early on? Like, what about them drew you to them? You know, because I mean, I think it's safe to say that most of us are exposed to Shakespeare or Balzac, you know, early on. Mm-hmm. Like, you're familiar with them, they're on the radar. But you open up a page and you instantly, as a 14-year-old, my feeling was always just forget that, it has nothing to do with me. I'll never read it again. But what for you, as a young man in Cuba growing up at 14, 15, you know, drew you to that? What about that?
I think it was the opposite, actually. I think it was the possibility of finding myself in those pages in a 19th century Parisian. Because, you know, back at the time I was studying a lot of science.
Right.
And science gives you a weird perspective or like a different perspective of life and put everything into its real place. You know, we're in a tiny planet, in a tiny solar system and so on. And I was shocked to see how similar human beings have been through the years. I mean, we do have different technologies. We do have different ways of expressing ourselves. But it's always been the same fears.
Yeah.
The same motive that drive us.
Right.
We are the same. That's why Greek philosophy is so contemporary, because you read them and you're reading basically about yourself.
That's right.
So how long after you started reading so voraciously did the first poem just bust out of you? And I imagine it busted out of you.
it was pretty soon. And also another important element that I forgot to mention is that I grew up listening to what is called a Cuban a Nueva Trova, no? Mm-hmm. A new movement of mm-hmm. musicians.
Yeah.
And they have a very poetic lyrics, right?
Yes.
So I grew up listening to Silvio Rodriguez.
Oh, man.
And it's a very hermetic poetry.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, somehow I was trained subconsciously to be knowledgeable in metaphors and cryptic meanings, if you want to.
Right.
And so my first poem were like very, very bad copies of Silvio Rodriguez and Pablo Milanés.
I
never,
Pablo,
you know, published them.
Yeah.
I destroyed them. You know, yeah. I have a lot of shame.
You don't have any left? Any today?
I love it.
No. A lot of shame of those points, but they were mostly in contact with that Nueva Trova movement.
Isn't a lot of us, I think, start with imitating poorly those writers that we
Well, musicians
admire.
Also.
Yeah.
Like for me, very much, like it was music that I early on was trying to imitate, you know, the Doors.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
I was going to say.
My
first poem
totally.
was a bad Jim Morrison.
Yeah, exactly right. It was like, you know, that sort of entry point of music being lyrical. And I can imagine, especially in Cuba with Silvio and Pablo Milanés, like, you know, those lyrics are incredibly lyrical and poetic, you know. I can't imagine that. But yeah, music always has a sort of, not always, but typically music is a sort of entry point for young folks to turning into writing, to turn to literature. Interesting. Or that the musician itself, we learned somehow that musician had been reading these books. Mm-hmm. So then we suddenly gravitate to those books.
Right, that's true, too.
Yeah.
We're talking to Nelson Cárdenas, poeta and a new faculty member in our Department of Creative Writing here at the University of Texas, El Paso. La Isla Que No Existe was your first book. Tell us how that book came about and where can people find that book? Do we have to go to Cuba to get it?
I think it's out of print already. So that book is a nonfiction book. It's about Cuban cultural identity.
Oh, it's not a book of poems.
No, it's a nonfiction book. It's about Cuban cultural identity. It's a literary essay.
Uh-huh.
And I basically did dialogue with non-Cuban diaspora writers. But the peculiar thing about that book is that when I finished my BA in the University of Havana, I think my thesis was like the second in the whole history of the Panamanian that was focused on diaspora writers. You know, when I was growing up, diaspora writers were non-existent. I mean, even nowadays, I just watch a video on YouTube. They ask people in Cuba about Reynaldo Arenas, and the people don't know who Reynaldo Arenas is in Cuba, which is shocking.
Wow. Yeah,
you know, I mean, one of the most important Cuban writers of all time, I would say. Yeah. So I started studying that, and I did it kind of playfully to find a crack to which I could escape some restrictions ideologically and philosophically.
So
I started talking, you know, about Cuban culture, because in Cuba, back at the time, I still nowadays, I think, the nation has been assumed by the state. So being Cuban means being in agreement with the government. Right. And I was saying, no, guys, wait a second. You know, I mean, whatever there is a croqueta, there is a Cuban. Whatever there is a, you know, like a conga playing Cuban beats, there is a Cuban. And then I found, like, super weird things. They would have, like, Cuban's Santeria web place based in Portland, Oregon, which is, like, a place you wouldn't expect a lot of tropical Santeria going on there. So that book was basically a book on essay in which I have a very long introduction, a very long first part that was a reflection on how to approach a culture from a place that includes the physical and geographical space of the nation, but doesn't limit what is Cuba to that island.
Do you think you ever might revise that and to republish it, you know, outside of Cuba?
That'd be great. I think like lately I have been thinking, I'm out of the masculine studies part, I have been thinking about that because I do deal with a lot of Cuban diaspora writers. And I think it would be interesting, of course. The thing is that now, not living in Cuba, I may have this complex of not being authorized enough to talk for Cuba, you know? It goes against what I wrote.
But you're the voice of the diaspora now, or you're an example of the diaspora.
It's an interesting situation that you're
I am. But yeah, I would love to revise it because I was young when I did that. And the funny thing is that won a national award, and the award was ceremony, but they published the book. That's how it got published, because back in the time in Cuba, it was published in 2002, so we still were coming out of the biggest recent crisis in our country. So no paper, I mean, no paper is not a metaphor. I mean, like, no paper. So no publishing. The only way to get published was to win an award. And so I won that Pinos Nuevos National Award on essay. And then the book got published. It was released in the book fair in Havana in February 2002. And in April, I took a plane to never go back. So it was a very coincidental.
Did you defect or did you get the right to leave?
I defected.
You defected. Wow.
I didn't defect because I just leave.
Yeah.
I mean, that word defecting has a military connotation that I don't agree with.
So you left. I just left.
That's right.
Yeah, I like that.
I remember when, you know, I went to Cuba in 2000 to do this exchange with U.S. writers and Cuban writers, and it was at the union in El Vedado. I think there's a writers' union there. And one of the things that the organizers of the exchange told us before we leave, you're going to be sitting around tables with Cuban writers, bring pens and paper and notepads to give to them. Wow. And we thought, what? And it was true. I mean, it was so valued even to have paper to write on. And that must make poetry and the desire to write just so much, I don't know, maybe more visceral, because you got to find a place to carve your words into.
I was kind of lucky because when I finished my BA, I went to work to Casa de las Americas. You know, it's like a very famous cultural institution that has a big role back in the 60s. You know, I mean, all the names that matter. Cortázar was there.
Acalá de Henares?
No, in Havana. Oh. The one in Spain is named after the one in Havana.
Oh,
the first one was in Havana in 1962. Wow. I think it was founded by the leadership there. And, Vargas Llosa was there, Cortázar was there, García Márquez was there, Donoso was there. So any name that you can think of in the 60s and 70s, they were connected to Casa. Anyway, they still have a very important literary prize. They don't give you a lot of money, but they have a lot of name to it.
Yeah.
And I remember writing in the back of the works that were rejected, you know. We received a bunch of paper, so I was kind of a palimpsest what I did, right? I had to turn the page and write in the other side of somebody else's writing.
Wow. Somebody else's writing. And then how did you, because you're also a film scholar, you also, you know, how did that suddenly get onto your radar? Or how did you find interest in that?
I think I have always been a film buff. You know, I have always watched a lot of movies, some of them like 16 times.
Like what movie have you watched 16 times?
Oh, it's a shame to confess, but
Freaky Friday with Lindsay Holmes.
The Matrix. I watched like six. Yeah,
no,
the whole idea of
movie,
a parallel.
Though, yeah, no, the whole idea, right?
I was back in Cuba, so the idea of a parallel reality was very appealing to me.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, that term Matrix comes from a secret cult society from hundreds of years ago, the idea of the Matrix. I mean,
really?
it's
a mathematical term.
Yeah, it really does access some, you know, a lot of.
After watching it 16 times, did you discover something by the 16th time?
Are you able to see beyond the veil?
No, nothing new to add there. So, you know, I started by watching movies, and then, you know, I consider a film from a creative perspective. Mm-hmm. When I was studying at UPenn, I dealt some in the documentary, but film just grew in me, and I started like seeing films as any other work of art. So I was able to see the different components, how they were combined, more or less effectively or not.
Right.
And I started to pay attention to the different details that make a good movie. I don't know, it just grew in me, and I didn't even notice. First, by watching films. Actually, my first English was from movies.
Right.
Because in Cuba, they would just put the subtitles. So it was listening English. That's why I curse a lot when I first arrived here, because in the movies, everybody's talking about that.
That's why you cursed a lot.
But right now you're working on poetry, right?
That is correct.
And before we go on, so we don't run out of time, we usually, like when we have poets, we love them to read a poem.
Yes.
Would you be willing to read something?
Yeah, sure. At this point, I'm not sure. I have two in here. I'm working on a book of poems that I have two parts. One is near the ocean. The other one is right here. It's a combination of what I was and what I am right now.
The ocean is just a desert with its life underground and a perfect disguise above.
many millions of it. Okay, so I'm guessing I'm going with this. So a little bit about this poem is that it was inspired by one image of Reinaldo Arenas in his novel El Color del Verano. He has this image that the people of the island start like eating out the islands go floating free in the ocean, but they never get, you know, any kind of agreement, so they sank and all of them. And so that idea of eating the island, and it also have a lot of drama to it, so bear with it.
Okay.
And it's called Hambre. Hambre. Observan por las ventanas los barcos, regresan cabizbajos. El hambre de sus bodegas presagia el hambre de los hijos. Con los labios sellados por el sol, se agolpan los marinos a la sombra de las tabernas. Adentro agoniza la música y deja la bailarina de mover sus caderas. Se oye el líquido dar en el líquido, la queja desatendida del cristal, la explosión del disminuido corcho de la última botella. Se oye el rugido del estómago del que reclina su silla en la columna de piedra, la respiración trabajosa del humo que asciende aterrado para escapar por las ventanas. En la plaza desgarran sus ropas ya raídas las más ancianas, desentierran la certeza que anuncia, es el hambre que vuelve en las bodegas de los barcos a reclamar sus lealtades. Trabajan pactos, proponen sacrificios, vislumbran las primeras víctimas. En los portales, los hijos detienen el curso de sus juegos y atienden al clamor visceral que los espía. Son la procesión de lo que falta. Cabizbajos escapan por calles laterales y se acunan en el regazo de las madres que no alimentan el carbón de las injurias, ni sazonan blasfemias, ni tragan rezos, sino que miran con furia la boca de los críos, de los marinos. Al horizonte, un último barco se asoma, y el más joven de los marinos mide la estrechez de su tierra. Sabe que esa costa es la misma costa de sus enemigos, y mientras surca, saciado de sol y sal, se extasía con el soplo sigiloso sobre la vela. Desembarca a la hora terrible y le recibe el brillo bestial en la mirada de su madre, fija en sus labios sellados por el líquido desierto. Le da la espalda y cae de rodillas y se escucha entonces el quejido mineral de las rocas cuando empieza a devorar la isla.
That is the voice of poet Nelson Cardenas, who is also a new tenured track professor here at the writing program at the University of Texas in El Paso. And that was his voice there that you just had the pleasure of listening to. Nelson, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you as I was listening to your poem is, you know, who are some of the poets that you feel maybe aligned with, you know, either contemporary or otherwise, you know, because as you said, you know, your first book was nonfiction, and now this is a book of, and this is what you're working on now is poetry. You know, are there any poets out there that you kind of feel a little bit like in conversation with or?
Nowadays?
Yeah.
Well, there are poets that I always go back to, right? They're mostly poets from 20th century, right. Vallejo, Huidobro. A little bit of Borges, but Borges, I have a love-hate relationship with his poet. I come and go. Lezama Lima and Eliseo Diego from Cuba. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, I have been lucky enough to meet one of the most important poets of my generation, Javier Marimón, who lives nowadays in Puerto Rico, Israel Dominguez, who lives in Cuba still, and even my wife, Andrea Gote. But I think, you know, I have a very fluid dialogue with them. And but, you know, each one has its own path, it's aesthetic.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely.
You mentioned your wife, Andrea Cote Botero, a fantastic poet who's kind of rocking the international poetry world right now with her work. And having a partner who's also a poet, I'm wondering, like, do you sometimes have to resist being influenced by her voice?
Oh, good question.
And do you share the poems with her?
Well, we first started sharing intellectual ideas when we were students at the university. You know, after a while, you don't remember who said what.
Right. Yeah.
Whose ideas? Very confusing. But, you know, he has. She has her voice, and I think I have mine.
Yes, she does.
So there are points that we don't touch. We don't, and there are some points in which we collide because we have different approaches to it.
Have you guys ever had an argument about poetry?
Never. That's a rumor. Don't get ever.
We've argued about a comma for an hour.
Comma. So I'm sorry, guys. I think that the hambre set the mood a little dark in here.
No.
It was beautiful poem. It was great. And so when can we expect to see your book of poems?
I don't know.
That's the question.
I'm about to finish the part about the liquid part of it, if you want to.
Uh-huh.
And I'm starting to work on the dry part of it, the desert part of it.
Wow.
I have been gathering a lot of images and a lot of ideas, but, you know, it takes time.
It's
a process.
Yeah. Right.
And there's no rush, right? We're not in a rock band. We don't need to release a record every year, right?
Yeah. Well, we're really lucky to have you in the writing program here at UTIP and, of course, to call you a colleague. And
thank you, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Nelson, right. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you very much,
thank
Nelson,
you for having me.
And thank you. And we'd also like to thank our producer, who will be leaving soon, but she's still here, Lauren Terrazas.
Lauren, yes, thank you so much for, you know, just for being so awesome and for making us sound smart, intelligent.
Yeah.
You know, that's most important right there.
Yeah, because this show was a half an hour, but really it took 2 hours to record. And she
that's
just
right.
edited it really
yeah,
well.
That's right, 2 hours. 2 hours.
Okay, maybe not.
No.
We're in the studio with Nelson Cardenas. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Thank you for joining us for season number 10.
Season 10.
Episode 1.
Stay tuned for all the episodes this season. They're going to be just as spectacular.
It's great to be back, and we'll see you next week.